Thank you very much, Brother Newbern. Alice and I have come back to Oklahoma to tell you one more time how much we think of your district superintendent and his beautiful wife, Joanne. As he said, we've known each other a long time. We were puppies together, and he served as DCAP in this district while I was serving as DCAP in Southern California. It's a delight to be here, and it's a delight to be with good people. I told Brother Newbern when he called me, I said, you know, I've been to Oklahoma so many times. I've told him everything I know. And he said, well, you know, just talk to us off the top of your head. So here's a sermon on dandruff. No, that's not true. He didn't say that. He said, just talk to us from your heart. That sounds more like Armin Newbern, doesn't it? You know, it's good to have good friends. And the older you get, the more you cherish friendships. Some of you young whippersnappers think, eh, I don't know that. Well, you'll find out. You'll find out. The older you get, the more you appreciate friends. Less than 6 weeks ago, I was sitting in a little sidewalk restaurant on the island of Patmos. And at the next table, there were two tourists, English-speaking tourists. Now, I should tell you, if we meet in restaurants anywhere, I am very good at picking up conversations from other tables. And I listened to these two people talk, and I was sitting there eating a Greek salad, and these two British people were talking, and one said, you know, I like Charles, but he's changing, and not for the better. He's not the Charles we knew when we were young. And it's a shame, he said, because Charles has all the right things to be a nice person. And I thought about that. Sitting there, thinking about my friends, some of whom fit that description. And some of whom probably think I do. And I tell you, as God is my witness, I thought of your superintendent, Armin Newbern. And I said to myself, the reason I think so highly of this man is that he's the same man I knew when we were puppies. Only he's grown more generous, more kind, he's more of a gentleman. He improves with age. Joanne said so. In fact, let me tell you something I heard him say at the district council. I was having lunch with the executive presbyters at the table, and he said that he had dedicated the rest of his life to making Joanne happy. That's a good role model, isn't it? You let us know if he doesn't do that, Joanne. Well, he has outlined for you what the district council, what he wants for the district council, or the brethren who are helping him have. And I would suggest you get with the program, because it sounds like tomorrow's the day, doesn't it? And if you miss tomorrow, you might be coming in here saying, what happened? And it was Ron Kirk in his book. He said, there's nothing worse than a nervous bishop, particularly when you are the one making him nervous. Don't want to make the bishop nervous. Just get with the program. I want to thank you, Brother Newbern, the executive officers, the presbytery, for inviting me once again. I think Brother Newbern said something about you're going to keep doing it till you get it right, so I'm going to try very hard to get it right this time. Ezekiel chapter 3. I'm going to use this text tonight and Wednesday morning. because I have more to say on the subject than you're willing to listen to tonight. So we'll pick it up again on Wednesday morning. Ezekiel was sent with a message to the people of God in bondage. And verse 13 says, the sound of the wings of the living creatures, this is chapter 3, the sound of the wings of the living creatures brushing against each other, and the sound of the wheels beside them, the loud rumbling sound, the Spirit then lifted me up and took me away. I went, listen to this, I went in bitterness and in the anger of my spirit with the strong hand of the Lord upon me. Seems to be a contradiction, doesn't it? I came to the exiles who lived in Tel Aviv near the Kibar River. That's where the people in bondage hung their harps on the willow trees, the land of Babylon. And there where they were living, I sat among them for 7 days, overwhelmed. Overwhelmed. This message is basic for missionaries, pastors, and by the way, let me say that I feel, fellow missionaries, as though I'm on holy ground tonight, sitting in this platform with you. I highly regard you, respect you. Amen. I was a missionary. I know what it takes to get there. These are some of the cream of the crop of our fellowship. Wonderful people. And I'm honored to be numbered among you, my friends. Yes. For missionaries, for pastors, for district officers, for Sunday school teachers, for deacons, for anybody in God's work. This message tonight is sort of ministry 101. It's basic. It's basic to everything. Sometimes we learn slowly, don't we? Or sometimes we forget. Sometimes we have to be reminded. Little Johnny said in the presence of his teacher, I have went. She said, you don't say that. That's improper. You say, I have gone. Shortly he did it again. I have went. She said, you're going to stay after school and you're going to write on the blackboard 100 times. I have gone. I have gone. I have gone. And he did. 100 times. I have gone. And he looked around. His teacher was nowhere to be found. And he left her notes. Says, I finished my work and I've went home. Some of us are slow in learning. We just don't catch on fast enough. And the reason I think is that some of us start where we weren't supposed to start. You have to start at the beginning. At the beginning. The little girl said to the lady in the rest home when the little preschoolers were visiting, she said, how old are you? The lady said, I'm 99. She said, oh, did you start at 1? Everybody starts at the beginning. But it's so difficult sometimes for us, particularly those of us in the ministry, to start at the beginning. We sometimes think we have an edge on others and we want to start down the road somewhere, missing some of the fundamentals of what the ministry is about. And this is one of them. This is most basic. Our commission is to shadow the world with the cross of Jesus Christ. And the reason for that is there's no alternative to the cross of Christ. There is no alternative. It's the cross or it's nothing. Jesus died on the cross for the sins of the world, and that is basic. We have that assignment. We were given that authority. Tarry until you be endued with power from on high. Why? To be witnesses unto him in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the uttermost parts of the earth. And Paul said, my message, my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest on men's wisdom, but upon God's power. Do you see that? The Spirit's power, so that your faith rests on God's power. That kind of preaching will determine what kind of converts one gets. God teach us early on, and if we haven't learned it yet, it's not too late tonight, that we must depend upon the Holy Spirit of God. There's none of us so wise, none of us so eloquent, none of us so smart that we can do without the touch of God upon our ministries. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. We know that from experience, some of us, we've tried it, as one of the beautiful young people here, and thank you so much for your ministry tonight, said to us tonight, it's not by might nor by power, but it's by my Spirit. That's what they were telling us in their ministry. And you see what the prophet Ezekiel experienced. And in today's world, the day of computers, of television, of radio, of advanced technology, far beyond what some of us even begin to understand, it makes available to us more information than we can assimilate. Your people in your churches, where you are ministering, are not suffering from lack of information. And so your job is not to pass on information. That may be part of the involvement of it, but that's not your assignment. They can get their information from their computers, from the television, from the radios, from the newspapers, from magazines. In fact, they're suffering from information overload every day they live. They don't know how to assimilate all of this stuff. And people have more information. They don't need enough anymore. They have enough. So the message alone is not enough. You see, the message alone. Ezekiel went with a message. But the message alone wasn't enough. What was the problem? Ezekiel was the problem. He said, I sat where they sat. There was the birth of the vision. I remained there astonished or amazed, he said. And that was the vision nurtured. Birthing the vision of what the ministry is about is sitting where people sit. The vision birthed may be at the very beginning of any successful ministry. It must be at the beginning of any successful ministry. There must be a vision. How many of you remember the time you knelt at God's altar somewhere, someplace, and the vision came, and God said, I've laid my hand upon you. You are my man, my woman. I'm going to use you mightily to the fullest extent of your ability. You remember that day, that hour, that time, the joy of it when you felt the hand of God upon your life. And the vision birthed will always be there. It never dies. It may be neglected, but it never dies. It's always there. I used to be a missionary. No, I am a missionary. I used to be a minister. No. I am a minister. I will always be a minister. Even if I throw away what I think is my calling, I will still have been called by God. One of the saddest things I saw when I was district superintendent in Southern California, when I was, I remarked today as we were driving in, I saw Rose Hill Cemetery. We have in Southern California, Whittier, a suburb of Los Angeles, Rose Hills, which is one of the largest cemeteries, I suppose, in the world, and it's been there forever. But as a boy, 11, 12 years old, I used to ride my bike up and down the streets, looking up at the Rose Hill sign, and down Rosemead Boulevard, which you wouldn't dare do today, but it was a different day then. And one of the things that I was allowed to do while we were in Montebello in East Los Angeles, down Rosemead Boulevard, several miles, there was another church and was pastored by a young pastor who had fiery red hair, blazing eyes, great talent, played the accordion, sang beautifully. I thought he was God's personal secretary. And I used to go to his church when they had vacation Bible school or any children's revival or anything. I used as an excuse, and I could ride my bicycle and go there alone. And I watched this man, and I thought as a little boy, oh, I'd like to be like this man. You know what this man did, Brother Newman? This man became so popular and was so well loved and well received in the ministry that he allowed himself to fall apart. You know, you can get so smart that God has a hard time using you. You can get so cute that God has a hard time using you. And he did. And then he thought he was somebody special. He started drinking. And drink got a hold of him. He had to resign his pastorate, and he became the town drunk. Policemen have picked him up and taken him home night after night off the streets. But that's not the end of the story. This man was called by God. We were beginning a district council, just as you are tonight. I walked back in the foyer, and I was shocked at what I saw. There was this man, now an old man. He didn't have decent clothes. He had on what at one time had been a white shirt, and it was rolled up to his elbows. No jacket. Shoes had no shine. Wrinkled pants. And he's standing in the foyer with his Bible under his arm, trying to get back, looking to see how many people knew him, might know him, might help him. And I said, Alice, that's one of the saddest things I've ever seen in my life. You never leave the call. The call of God is without repentance. We'll get to that tomorrow night. But if you were ever a missionary, if you were ever a pastor, if you were ever a minister, you will always be, no matter what. But we need to go no further than the Gospels to find one who modeled that for us. The Lord identified with people. He empathized with people. He was not content to dwell in heavenly places. He wanted to dwell where people were. Oh, the multitude is what he wanted. He wanted to be with people. He wanted to help hurting people. It was the disciples who said, Lord, send these people away. They're bugging us. He said, we can't do that. We've come to be of help. You see, he left everything. He sat where we sit to know us. And aren't you glad he did? Aren't you glad he sat where you sit to understand you, to know you, to feel as you feel? He bore our griefs. He carried our sorrows. He sat where we sit in order to identify with our hurt. And that's why the writer of the Hebrews could say, we have not an high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tempted like as we are, and yet without sin. And that's what we must do. We must sit where people sit. I have never subscribed to the idea of ministry where we are placed upon some pedestal somewhere and ask the congregation to come by and kiss our boots. That's not what a man or a woman of God is. We are a servant among people. We will always be servants among people as long as we are ministers of God. And we must never, never fail to sit where people sit. A man was sitting in a restaurant, saw a little face peering through the window right near his table. little street urchin. A man got up and walked out and said, "Son, what are you looking for?" And he said, "I was just looking to see what everybody was eating." He said, "Are you hungry?" And he said, "Yes, sir, I am." He said, "Come on inside. Take this chair at my table. What do you want, a hamburger and french fries?" He ordered up for him. They brought the plate and put it in front of him. And he just sat there and looked at it. The man said, "Come on, that's yours. It's all yours. Eat it. I bought it, paid for it. It's yours." "I can't," he said. He said, "You can't? Why can't you?" He said, "It's Billy." He said, "What do you mean it's Billy?" He said, "Billy's my friend. You don't have anything to eat either. I can't eat without Billy." Well, he goes hungry. That's sitting where they sit. That's feeling what people feel. That's sitting where they sit, identifying with those who have not. It's so easy for us to believe that our work, our interests, our particular frustrations constitute the hub of the universe. They do not. Jesus taught us, and if he taught us anything, he taught us that doing for others, forgiving, loving, second miles, was the heart of the gospel. Before we can help other people, we must love them, we must understand them. What really reached Ezekiel's heart was that these captive people, displaced, lost souls, were without. They'd stopped having song services. Their harps were hanging on the trees. They were hurting people. That's what birthed the vision for him. It was heart. It was heart in the ministry. And my brothers and sisters, when the heart goes out of the ministry, there is no ministry. Because you know physically that when the heart dies, when the heart stops beating, the whole body dies. And the heart in the ministry is what the ministry is about. People without a Bible, people without a prayer, people without a song of praise, people who know nothing of righteousness, people without the hope of salvation. Ezekiel said, "I sat where they sat, and I sat there 7 days. I was astonished. I went there in bitterness of spirit and angry, but I was astonished as I sat among them." Why? Because I began to understand how they felt, what their needs were. I sat where they sat. Maybe I've mentioned here before, but when we were in Greece, I went up to Katerini to preach. We have a good strong church in Katerini, just south of Thessalonica. And I'd been there several times. I was there for 3 days, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday with the pastor. Sitting on the platform, and I see a young couple sitting in the front row, and this guy is singing as loud. He's singing. He can't sing. He couldn't carry a tuna bucket with a lid on it, but he sang loud. And I said, "Who's that?" "New converts," he said. "Oh," he said, "I'll tell you about them after church." After church, he told me this couple had come into the church and had found Christ. They'd gone out. Every Greek carries an identification card, and he carries on this card a number of things: his name, his father's name, his religion. And he went to the police station and said, "I want you to change my card. I'm no longer Orthodox. I'm a Pentecostal believer now." Well, that did it. Every Greek has a file. When I lived there, I had 3 files in 3 different police stations. And I've seen all 3 of them. And I never broke a law, as far as I know. They pulled out his file and they changed it. But word got out very quickly. And he went back to his little village, about 5 kilometers out of Katerini. And he was ostracized by the whole village, where he'd grown up as a kid. Went to buy a loaf of bread in the bakery the baker had known him all his life. And the baker said, "Get out of my shop. I don't sell bread to dogs." He lost his job. He didn't have a car. He had a motorbike. That was the family car. He and his wife and baby rode to church. every time the doors open, 5 kilometers on that motorbike. He said, maybe we should go see them. He'd be thrilled if we would. I said, let's do. We went to the house. We drove up in front. I'm driving a Speed the Light vehicle purchased by the young people of Assemblies of God. The whole village thought the president was rolling into town. We came in, and they met us at the front in tears. Welcome to our spitaiki. You put Ike on the end of anything in Greek, and it becomes tiny. Spiti is house. Welcome to our spitaiki. And they took us inside. In the living room, 2 wooden chairs and a table. They gave us the chairs. They went in the kitchen, brought back 2 boxes, wooden boxes, and sat down on them. Put them right in front of us. Now we're knee to knee and nose to nose. And he wants to know if they can sing for us. And I'm saying to myself, he's got to be joking. He can't sing. I've heard him sing. Pastor said, sure, sing to us. The Greeks carry their songbooks and their Bibles to church. He reached in his back pocket and pulled out this little songbook and opened it up. Told his wife what they're going to sing, and they sat there blowing their souvlaki breath in our face, singing as loud as they could. The dog started howling. It was awful. And then he said something to her. Brother, when the Greeks entertain, you come into their, cross the threshold of their house, whatever they have, they must share something with you. They are very hospitable people. Said something to his wife. She went to the kitchen. She came back with 2 saucers and 2 teaspoons. Remember, he lost his job. They were living in abject poverty. He handed us 2 saucers, 1 for the pastor, 1 for me, and in the middle of each saucer was a spoonful of jelly. I took the spoon and started eating that jelly. But before we did, he said, let me pray. Let me pray, O Pateramus, if God is to me, Parapolia, if Heavenly Father, we thank you so very, very much. And I'm thinking, what does he have to thank God for? When I got home, I said, told Alice about it. I said, you know, there's a word that doesn't belong in our vocabulary. It's the word sacrifice. We don't know sacrifice. Americans don't know sacrifice. We get all bent out of shape because we don't have enough money to make the payment on our new car. Well, ti krima, as the Greeks say, what a pity. We don't know sacrifice. And something happened in my heart sitting in that humble little spitaiki that changed me forever, because I sat where they sat and I began to understand how these people felt and lived. I understood their heart. He sat where they sat. And with Ezekiel, I remained there astonished among them, which is a must for the ministry. I remained there astonished. The risk of being widely viewed by some of you as being an out-of-step graybeard who might try to put a screen door on a submarine. I want to tell you something about the ministry. God never called us to set up bureaucracies. God never called us to set up computer systems. God never called us to set up offices. God didn't call us to, some of these things may be necessary. Although I do know by statistics that a 4-drawer file cabinet will cost you $25,000 to fill it up, and 80% of everything that's in it will never again see the light of day. It just says how smart we are. We are smart people. We know how to tuck it away. When our ministry deteriorates to the point where our attention is focused on machinery, the emphasis of our ministry has shifted to things, and then there is a loss of a sense of urgency, because the urgency only comes when it involves people. I listened to the superintendent and the presbyters back in this room. As we had prayer tonight, mentioning some of these people whose names were called from this pulpit, who needed prayer. And I sensed in the voices of some of these men a sense of urgency. Why? Because they're living, breathing people. People whose bodies are hurting. People who need a touch from God. People who are loved. And people who need someone to care tonight. We are not called to things, we're called to people. And one of the worst things that can hit us, my brothers, my sisters, is that of faded visions and corroded spirits. God help us to remain there among the people, astonished, stunned, devastated, overwhelmed. All these words are words to translate that word. We have churches full of peeping Toms today. People just want to peep in and see what's happening. They don't want to really get involved. They just want to peep in. And some of them peep in and peep right out. And the reason, one of the reasons I think is that there is not the atmosphere that says to these people, we love you. You know, your pastor can be the worst preacher in the world. He may not be able to preach his way out of a wet paper sack. But if he loves people, if he loves people, if he loves people, those people will die for him because they understand the importance of being loved. Now, let's understand as we approach the end of this that the people of this ancient city of Tel Aviv were in fact rebellious people. They deserve God's judgment. God said so. But isn't that the story of mankind everywhere? Sometimes pastors say, oh, I'm sick of these people. I'm going to change. I'm going to pastor another church. I'll go ahead. The same people are there. You're not going to get away from them. Wherever you go, there they are. Old Brother Smith and that other church, as a brother in the church you're going to, looks like him, acts like him, and just as much devilment. You see, it's the attitude we have toward the ministry. Whether it's Tel Aviv, Springfield, Missouri, Oklahoma City, Los Angeles, California, the greater issue was Ezekiel's attitude and disposition regarding his assignment. He went there with a, you're all going to hell, ha ha, attitude. And the message, he was ready to give it to him. Oh, he had it. Finally polished. He marched over to those poor lost souls, prepared to pronounce judgment upon them. Isn't it easy to do that? We are professionals at pronouncing judgment. Yeah, you listen to me, you stiff-necked people. Let me tell you what God thinks of you. And Ezekiel started to pronounce the judgment. Words of condemnation were about to be uttered. He had righteous demands stuck in his briefcase. He was ready. But when he arrived, fortunately for him, he didn't run right to the pulpit. He thought about it for a while. Dwight Brown, my dear friend in Southern California, who's not a well man today, but I've talked about him all across the world. He's a great cornfield philosopher. When I was a young man, he said, Everett, let me tell you something about pastoring people. When you go to a church, don't do anything the first year, but love those people. Just love them. Just love them. After that, you can do anything you want to. People want to be loved. They want to understand that somebody's there who identifies with them. And Ezekiel sat down to catch his breath and offer his pronouncements. And the longer he sat there, the more he realized that he was in the right place with the wrong spirit. He began to realize that this scathing, censorious message he was about to deliver was coming from an impure heart, and it stuck in his throat. He went there to fight, but oh my, that night, God certainly got a hold of him. The God of compassion.
You know yourself that the same message can be preached by two people with two different effects. One man can preach the sermon and leave people running out of the church saying, I'm never going back. Another man or woman can preach the same sermon and people will be running to the altars saying, I'm so glad I came, I met God there. And so much of it depends upon whether or not we have sat where those people sit and understand their heart and feel with compassion all their hurts and their needs. And let me tell you what I hear the prophet Ezekiel saying. He said, I sat where they sat and I remained there astonished. And I know that as I sat there, the brush of angels' wings, I heard God say, these are my people and I love them. For all their sins, I love them. Oh, let's be certain, my brothers, my sisters, that when we speak words of judgment, that our hearts are pure and right before God. What a transformation for Ezekiel. Ezekiel tucked that powerful sermon into the back of his briefcase, and it probably never again saw the light of day because he had a wrong spirit. This prophet, who was so eloquent and had his arguments honed to fine perfection, no doubt he was ready, found himself with nothing to say, in bitterness and the anger of my spirit. You see, T.S. Eliot in Murder in the Cathedral has these words: the last temptation is the greatest treason, to do the right deed for the wrong reason. And so there he is. He was among captive people, huddled there with them in their poverty, his bitterness melting away. There he sits where the captives sit. Sure, he'd known God, but he'd never really known how God felt about lost people. Now he identifies with them. Never again will the prophet Ezekiel rebuke without tenderness. Oh, it's so important, my friends. Rebuke, there may be times for rebuke, but only with tenderness and compassion, the compassion of Christ. He identifies with these people and their lostness, but he's not going to condemn them again without condemning himself. And if God would bring us all to that sacred place, what a different place the church world would be. What a different place. You see, if I would be a father, let me see through the eyes of my children. Alice and I were talking the other night. You know that we lost our youngest daughter 5 years ago. We were talking about our families, and some pictures reminded us of those early days, and we said that we'd like to go back and relive them, maybe, if we could have our two daughters and our two sons back at home with us and know now what we knew, know then what we know now. Wouldn't we love to do that? I'd be the best father in the world. Wouldn't be any daddy that could come within 10,000 miles of me. I know how it's done now. But I'm not sure I did it then. If I'm going to be a father, I have to see through the eyes of my children. If I'm going to be a husband, I have to see through the eyes of my wife. I have to know how she feels. And I'll never understand her in 1,000 years, but I do constantly try to read her. Sometimes I'm right, sometimes I'm entirely wrong. But if I would be a minister, then I must sit where the people sit. I must understand the people. I must feel their broken spirits. When I was a pastor, I did what some of you pastors do, perhaps on a regular basis. When I was prepared for the Sunday morning service, maybe it was Friday or even Saturday, I would get up and walk out of my office across the garden to the sanctuary. And I'd go in that huge, cavernous, darkened sanctuary. And I'd sit down in a chair somewhere in a pew and sit there and pray, Lord, whoever sits in this seat Sunday morning, let me feel something about what they feel. Let me understand them. Let me not try to be so hip and so cool and so smart that I blow over the heads of all their hurts. Let me minister to them because I'm sitting where they're sitting. How easy it is for us to become surly and ungracious and harsh in judgments toward people. We've not bothered maybe to understand people who perhaps have little or no resources for self-defense. How easy it is to shove somebody else down the ladder to preserve our own self-esteem and personal ambitions. You see what I'm saying? It's so easy to short-circuit the vision. That's key, sitting where they sit. I think I probably shared with you something that happened when I hadn't been in headquarters very long, and G. Raymond Carlson, as you know, was the general superintendent. I told this story at his funeral in Springfield last January, was it? I think in January. In January. But we had a man working in the publishing house, whom I did not know, who was sick unto death. And whose son was sick unto death. The man was there. He had a son, a grown son, who had his own kids, and he was there. And when we came in that morning, word passed around, he's not going to live through the day. And as we came to the end of coffee break time in the morning, G. Raymond Carlson put his head through my door and he said, "The brother has died. And the family is asking that we come and be with them. Would you like to go?" I did. I didn't know the man. And I thought maybe it wasn't a good use of my time. I wasn't a pastor. Neither was G. Raymond a pastor. Yes, he was. G. Raymond was every inch a pastor. He lived and died being a pastor. He tried to pastor 1,100 people in headquarters. I've seen him so many times, standing in the hallway with his arm around somebody, crying with them. Crying with them. Sitting where they sit. That was one of his great, great traits, characteristics. And we walked across the street to the hospital and across the parking lot as we're walking. I have to tell you, I was saying to myself, why are we doing this? I have so much work to do. I know he has more work to do. I don't know these people. Why are we walking over here? And we got there, two pastors were already there. And I didn't understand until something happened. We went up to the third floor of the hospital, got out of the elevator and began walking down that long, polished floor, corridor. And a little boy whose father had just died, saw Brother Carlson. He knew him. And he came running down that corridor with his arms out. And when he reached Brother Carlson, he threw his arms around his legs and sobbed. His daddy had just died. G. Raymond Carlson bent over to pick up that little boy and was not successful in the attempt and ended up sitting on the floor of the boy in his arms. And I could see it and will see it to the day I die. He sat there on the floor in a suit and a white shirt and a tie, sitting on the floor with a little boy in his arms, sobbing, rocking back and forth with that little boy, crying with him. God said, "Stenhouse, you see that? That's what the ministry's about. It's not about that headquarters building. It's not about computers, typewriters, file cabinets, committee meetings. Oh, God delivers from committee meetings. It's not about those things. It's about people. It's about people." And as I sat there listening and watching,
G. Raymond Carlson, I said, Brother Newbern, I said to myself, the whole general council should see this, should be able to look into this hospital corridor and see the general superintendent sitting on the floor with a little boy cradled in his arms, rocking him, comforting him, sitting where that little boy sits, suffering the loss of his father with him. And G. Raymond never lost that. He never lost that. And I shared that with this casket in front of the pulpit in Central Assembly, because I thought those people needed to hear what had happened. Now that's what the ministry's about, whether it's missionary, pastor, evangelist, whatever. It's about sitting where they sit and identifying with their needs and feeling their hurt. I just came from Calcutta a few months ago, and I preached in the Mark Buntain Church. And I was reminded of when I was there before, and Mark was in the hospital not long before he died. And the Reformed priest came in, Reformed Church priest came in, robes, big cross, hanging, wooden cross hanging on his belly. And I was ready to leave because of going to South India from there, and I just preached in the church and walked in the hospital, and they have the hospitals hooked up with closed circuit television. They can watch the church service if they want, and that's about it. I walked in the room and Mark said, oh, what a service we had today. And he had needles stuck in every part of his body. We're talking, getting ready to pray, and Mark looked past me to the door and said, come in, brother. And I turned and saw this priest. The priest walked in and he said, Brother Mark's my spiritual father. I said, really? Yes. He said, I've been in the priesthood all my life. Brother Mark led me to Jesus. Brother Mark explained the baptism of the Holy Spirit to me, and I was baptized in the Holy Spirit, speaking the heavenly language. Brother Mark's my spiritual father. And I said, good. I was just getting ready to pray. You lead us in prayer. I'm coming close to missing my airplane for South India. And it's a long ways to the airport. A lot of sheep and cattle between the Calcutta and the airport. And we joined hands. Each took one of Mark's hands and we joined hands across his body. Mark really never recovered from that. Shortly after, he went to be with the Lord. But I'll never forget that moment. I asked that priest to pray. Did he pray? Sound just like Mark Buntain. Oh God! Oh, we thank you for your healing power. And I said to myself as I left, Mark Buntain will be alive as long as that man's alive. Why? Because Mark sat where those people sat, among them, to feel their compassion, their hurt. He lived with them for 3 decades, touching lives. Now, my friends, that's what the ministry is. It's nothing less than that. If we don't identify, if we don't have compassion, if we don't sit where they sit, we're not going anywhere in the ministry. If we do, we're going everywhere with God, because God's going to lead us there. Let's stand together, shall we? Father, I pray that you will help us tonight to open our hearts to the knowledge that our ministry utterly depends upon the compassion that God pours into us, and help us to be willing to sit where people sit. To sit where people sit, to feel their compassion, to feel their hurt, to reach toward them with all the love of Christ, because God has loved us and touched their lives. Through our own lives, we pray. I think it would be good for us to close this service tonight. I've asked the musicians to help me and all of us to sing Audrey Meyer's chorus, To Be Used of God. To be used of God, to sing, to speak, to pray. To be used of God, to show someone the way. It can only happen, my brother and sister, when we sit where they sit. And maybe you haven't done it.
Maybe your pastor, you need to go home from here and sit on the pew of your empty church and say, Lord, I want to sit where these people sit. I want to understand them. I want to feel their hearts. I want to feel their hurts. I want to know where these people are. God can use you starting right there. Maybe figuratively we can sit where they sit tonight. I'd like to invite you to come around the front, the altars. Let's kneel. Let's spend a few moments of time on our knees before God and say, Lord, I want to sit where my people sit as we sing together.